when something like really life-changing happens to you, to be like extremely vicious with what are the things that you're going to keep in your life. Constraints are not only just things you do to generate creativity that can be fun exercises, like, oh, now let me make a joke only using the color green. But it can also be like, hey, these things are no longer important to you, and just being really aware that it's not important to you. And I just had this creative itch and I started figuring out, hey, what do I really want?
Hi there. Welcome to Lessons in Creativity, where we'll explore the creative process across different disciplines and learn how to harness this natural part of our human experience. I'm Jenna Massey, your host and fellow student. In this episode, I spoke with Adi Surendran. Adi is a comedy writer who grew up in New Jersey after his parents moved to the U.S. from India. He started his career as a lawyer, but events in his personal life, along with his love of comedy, caused him to gradually develop his writing skills in the form of mundane, short, comedic stories. After going to open mics and participating in writers' groups for several years, he self-published his collection of short stories into a book called Cheese Doza. In this episode, he shares about his journey, his writing process, his views on creative identity, and some definite hot takes along the way. I hope you have fun listening. Adi, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
So to start, I would love to think about you age 7, 8, 9. And when you were around that age, how did you see creativity show up?
Interesting question. Also, I've noticed any time that I tell anyone what I was doing as a kid, 7, 8, or 9 ends up being the age I claim I was doing it. I realize I couldn't possibly have done all of those things at 8 years old, but 7, 8, 9 does feel like what I consider childhood. So at 7, 8, or 9, I was about 3 or 4 or 5 years into living in the United States. We lived in a very tiny apartment. It was one bedroom. So up until high school, I was sleeping on a little dusty couch. Wow. And if anyone's read like Oliver Twist or something, you can have that general view in your head. But there was that. But then my mom also had a job in travel. And so she got to travel around representing airlines that didn't have airplanes that traveled to the U.S., but they certainly wanted American tourists in these particular countries. Mauritius, Madagascar, Lithuania, Zimbabwe. These were all countries I would get to visit as a 7, 8, or 9-year-old. And then ironically come back to my couch that was my quote-unquote room where the TV was, etc. So for me, creativity, getting finally to your question, like most creative people, we don't just answer the we just don't answer the question in one sentence. Creativity for me early on was like, how can we do more with less to some degree, whether that was. And so in a similar vein, that was what life was like growing up. We were doing a lot, but where it never felt like we had very little, because one night would be Mexican night and Japanese night. And then, of course, Indian food, many of the days, maybe every other day. But we were always experimenting with food. We were always getting outside of that particular apartment complex. I think my parents knew very early on that your environment can really dictate who your friend circle is, et cetera, dictates maybe what path you might go down. So they made sure that like all of the nerdy kids from the other end of town, they became friends with their parents and just ensured that I was always off at somebody else's house playing over there.
It's so interesting because constraints are such an important part in the creative process.
Yeah.
And so you brought that up, that you discovered that kind of early on of, okay, how can we do more than less with less?
Yeah, I think anytime, especially if you've got any listeners that are like, I want to write a book someday. I know what that feels like for 20 plus years where you just have that general notion. The constraint that you can put on that is, in my case, all of my stories, I got in my head, I'm like, hey, if I'm going to figure out what my quote unquote voice is, I maybe need to start putting some constraints. And so the one constraint I put on was every plot line has to be really boring. Like it has to literally be me and my dad went fishing. We didn't catch any fish. That's the plot. But then how through the writing and your personality are you going to make that interesting?
So we've got creative constraints, a lot of cultural exposure, and some entrepreneurial instincts. The next thing I wanted to ask you about is where that interest in writing and storytelling and comedy came from.
My dad was a storyteller. He was very funny. He also was good at telling scary stories. Yeah, so definitely he plays a big role in how funny he was. I don't know if this is true. I think it's true of like definitely over 50% of Indian families, perhaps more. But I could say with some confidence it's over 50%. there's a lot of the, at least in the kids who grew up in the 90s, this would be a very common thing in an Indian American home where like your parents would be hanging out with an uncle and an aunt, some family friends on a couch, and they would just call you out of your room, which in my case was the couch, so I was already there. But they would just call you out and have you stand in front of them and start doing something, like performing something or another. It could be singing a song for them. Just entertain us. And, you know, back then, this was the 90s. I've talked to a couple of my friends who are introverted. And the more I learn about them and how they live their lives, I'm like, damn, I think I'm introverted, believe it or not. But I think it was some portions of that were like beaten out of me. And I'm like finally discovering that I'm an introvert, which actually incidentally will lead to why I started writing. But I didn't have it. The introversion was not an option when I was 7, 8, or 9. Like just come out there, start making jokes, singing a song, et cetera. So just like entertaining people at a very young age, and they are a solid 5 to 6 times older, is very common. And the more Indian people I meet outside of my little town after going off to college and law school and stuff, I realized, oh wow, this is a shared experience of having to do something like this. There was definitely that. And then finally, I'd be remiss in not mentioning, I have an uncle, he passed at this point maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and he was an extreme influence on my just my worldview in general. There'd be he lived in Chicago for most of the time I knew him, and he's actually the last chapter in my book, Cheese Dosa, and incidentally, it's chapter 23, purposely 23 chapters, because I was a big Michael Jordan dork fan. He was also from Chicago, and that last chapter is just dedicated to him, and just like a moment we shared while we were down there. But he was someone I could just watch Dave Chappelle with, early Dave Chappelle, naturally, because I was 7, 8, or 9 years old at this point, and just watch comedians, watch movies, dissect little moments in a movie that were fun, and not dissect it in like an uber scientific way. We'd be laughing each time we keep replaying it, but then just noticing the little ticks or little movements. And later on, I would find out that what was happening here was that these actors were going off script. They were just really good improvisers. They were listening to each other. So all the vocabulary would come later. But in that moment, we would just share these moments where we'd watch comedians. He introduced me to all of the Beatles songs that my parents didn't introduce me to, so all of the Delic stuff. And it was just such a cool influence. And I don't think there were a lot of Indian uncles necessarily who had such a command of American or at least like Western music and culture like he did, while also naturally he had plenty of Indian culture. But definitely a huge influence on what I think is funny, the command of language, creating puns like it's a sickness. Yeah.
That's so cool. And especially because I'm sure with coming from India and having cultural differences with comedy and with improv and storytelling, I'm sure there's so much that you probably had in your culture that just doesn't appeal to American humor and comedy. So it's like, what a gift that you had someone who was also so interested in it. And then you're able to learn.
Yeah, it is interesting. It feels, you're absolutely right. There's some jokes that may not necessarily translate, but I am finding out more often than not that maybe there was just not like a forum or a space to express it. And there's always, when you're telling stories and you need to figure out who your audience is, I know that like one of the, I'm going to botch this Russell Peters joke, so forgive me. God forbid if this ever gets heard by him, but it was something about, he's talking about when he was maybe 7, 8, or 9 years old, and he's with his friend who's white, and his friend tells him, his parents come in, but bust into his room, start yelling at him about something, and his friend says, hey, you know what you should do the next time your parents come in and start yelling at you? You should tell them, I'm gonna call child services. And Russell Peters' eyes grow wide. He's a 7-year old in the story, and he's, oh my God, I didn't even know that was an option or whatever. And so that continues on. I would definitely botch that longer form of the joke, but the short answer is where the white friend is finding out that Russell Peters gets hit by his parents every now and then. And Russell Peters finds out that his white friend, we'll call him Andy. I think that was his name actually in this hypothetical story. He's, Andy, you never get hit by your parents? He's like, no, they just sent me to my room. And Russell Peter goes, you have a room? And in that moment, I was like, you can imagine why I'm connected with that.
Right.
But I think looking at that, there's also something brilliant about how he's executing that joke, right? He's bringing people in through, let's say you didn't have that shared experience. Let's say you're not Indian American. Let's say your parents are not strict. somewhere on the spectrum, you're either Andy or Russell. And so you at least can identify with a parent who never hit you or just always came down to face level and did all the stuff that the psychologist told him to, of how you like speak to your kids and stuff. And so he's turning the mirror on both. And unless you just refuse to be open and curious, you're going to understand where Russell's coming from. You're going to understand his lived experience. There's some empathy developing because there's literally a character learning about what's happening in this story. And so he didn't have to start with some boring narrative of, hey, audience, in case you weren't aware, Indian parents can be very strict, etc. There's a lot of showing rather than telling, which is a common device in writing and in movies. And once you've heard that phrase, if you haven't heard that phrase before, dear listeners, you'll start to see, oh, those movies that I really like, it's because there's a lot more showing than telling happening in it. There's not a lot of long exposition about what's happening in a scene. You just find out that the character's scared because there's something in their face that's making them look scared. And in this case, you find out an entire portion of the lived Indian child experience through this, you have a room moment idea as well.
No, it's really masterful. It's fascinating. Yeah. Okay, so you wound up pursuing law and then eventually switched into your career now in client services. So at what point did you really start actually writing and stand up and comedy while you were along your career?
Yes. In law school itself, and my friends, hopefully they never share these emails. So I created this email thread, which was not just like only my best friends. It was some people were on this thread that I just admired as writers themselves, people who were willing to give feedback, people who I thought were funny and weren't even necessarily friends with me. And I think that was the important part for me. That's what this email thread represented. Just a bunch of people who were either neutral observers or good comedians themselves in general. And on this email thread, I would just start creating anything. There was no rules to this email thread other than every subject line in the email had to start with the word my and then something. So I was just giving it a title and it'd always be my something. This would be anything from, there was this surprisingly popular song. I actually forget the name of the song, but you'll recognize the tune like, by Sean Kingston, called Somebody Call 911, Shorty Fire Burning on the Dance Floor. So one of my entries, comedic genius that I was in law school, was like, what if we took those lyrics and one by one turned those lyrics into a conversation with a 911 call operator?
Take us through a couple of the lines because it's really funny.
So yeah, everything here is in between 911 dispatch and Sean Kingston. 911, where's the emergency? Somebody call 911. Yes, sir, you've got us. Where's the emergency? Shorty Fire burning on the dance floor. Shorty Fire? Whoa. Dispatch pulls up Urban Dictionary. I see. How badly was your shorty burned? Shorty got that super thing hotter than the sun of south of Spain. I see. That sounds like a third degree burn. Sir, you need to... I gotta cool her down. Exactly. Yeah. EMS is on its way, but the first 5 minutes are critical. Have you provided any assistance? And then it just continued. And it turns out these lyrics, if you just cherry pick the right lyrics, it can actually turn into an entire conversation.
What a great idea. That is so funny. Wow.
But so there'd be that. Then some of them would be some short stories. Some of them would just be like two or three lines. Half of them would probably get me canceled today, but that opportunity to play with a group of people who will give you feedback and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Then the responses and stuff, some people would comment back, or not just with feedback necessarily, just jokes would continue onwards. Like we would just keep building on it. Hey, what if this thing happened during this moment and this, and some other Sean Kingston song would get thrown into the 911 emergency call. And so you just had, it was like almost having a writer's room of people who were, many of them were lawyers who had a creative itch to scratch too, finding that safe space and playing around with. So yeah, that email threads, it turns out, are free and continue to be. So that was like a really quick and easy way. And I hope it goes without saying, nothing of this was like, I need to create this email thread because 12 years later, I'm going to write a book. A lot of this was having a sense of play in mind.
I love
needing an outlet of some kind. It's almost like the writing will, if you really want to write, like you, and if you, if from a funny perspective or a serious perspective, like a part of you knows that you'll just be doing it once you're actually ready. Mm. And so for me, that email thread was like the beginnings of that.
That's really cool. I think what's also so interesting is your focus on the mundane stories and the everyday. But like with that comes this observation layer and like curiosity about the human experience and what's going on internally. Like, where does that come from? Because that's really key in comedy.
Yeah, I think there's probably two large pillars. The first pillar I can think of is definitely just the artistic influences in my life. Growing up as a child of the 90s, Seinfeld, you were either a Seinfeld or a Friends fan. And hopefully I haven't isolated half of the listeners here, but I was like, it wasn't even close how much of a Seinfeld fan I was then versus a Friends fan. Like, sitting around living in unrealistic apartments, drinking out of a giant coffee mug. Like I didn't drink coffee. I still don't. And I just don't get it, but good for you if you're a Friends fan. that can be your thing that creates a lot of controversy in the comments.
Seinfeld or Friends. This is one of our most controversial moments to date on the podcast.
So Seinfeld is, of course, like the show about nothing, right? And so for me, that was like, it clearly seemed possible. I think the greatest trick about that show to probably a lot of people who were inspired enough to go down a similar path was it never felt like this massive effort, right? It's just people like opening, it's one dude opening doors with a certain gusto in Kramer. And so eventually felt achievable. I now look back on it and realize, yeah, there's no chance that I could have written a show like that. There's so much more going on. And it turns out there was only one person, and it's not even Seinfeld, that it is in fact Larry David who can do that particular type of writing, as I would find out later on. But between that and a writer named David Sedaris, who is a hilarious comedian. A lot of David Sedaris' stories are, in fact, little moments, unremarkable plot lines, but through just really incredible storytelling. He was like the first writer that I realized, oh, you can be like funny in a book. And I don't know necessarily how many other books are out there that are like, that actually make you laugh maniacally. Naked and Me Talk Pretty One Day are two recommendations I would give to anyone who wants to like see what this form is about. As far as I know, it seems to be David Sedaris who's cornered this entire way of doing things.
It's such a good point you bring up. They make it look so easy when you're like telling such a simple, mundane, everyday story, but there's so much underlying it.
Yeah. So if I remember how I was organizing this, that was the first pillar, like artistic influences. Mm-hmm. The second one of like how we got to this way of creating a constraint where only boring things must happen goes to a slightly darker place. So after law school ends, about a year or two afterwards, it was May of 2012, and it was Mother's Day. I was coming home from D.C. At the time, I was an antitrust lawyer in D.C., and my dad has this, he's in the kitchen, and we hear this like crazy loud thud in my parents' house, and he has passed out and collapsed and hit his head on the back of his head on the floor of the kitchen floor, which was like a sort of tile. I'm driving to the hospital. We get there. We find out that he's like bleeding inside his brain. Let me also cut the tension here a bit and just say that he's doing great now. All like a bunch of stuff that happened during that phase, like it's fully recovered from.
Yeah.
Just so that this is not like a horror podcast that we're creating, right? To my knowledge, know that this plane lands safely. But while this blood stuff is happening and they're running those tests, they also find out that he's got prostate cancer as well while hospital.
Wow.
And I'm just thinking, is he going to leave this hospital or not? And when he wakes up, he is completely out of sorts for a few days. His personality has changed. Note that my dad is one of my comedic influences, and he's become like this really irritable, nasty person all of a sudden. And that feels very different and weird to see like your father's personality change a lot of it. And so I'm like struggling with all of that. But long story long, I ended up not ever the only, like, when I was leaving DC to go home for Mother's Day, it turns out that was like the last time I would be a lawyer and the last time I would even go back to living in DC. So wow. I just stayed in New Jersey for a while. Partner at the law firm was actually pretty nice in that I think he understood what I was going through. So literally let me be a lawyer from home. And I was like writing stuff that eventually it was an antitrust case involving, I think it was like Universal, Sony, and EMI, these major music labels. And one of them was merging with the other. And there was like a congressional hearing about it. And I remember my dad finally comes back from the hospital and he's still out of sorts, but we're watching C-SPAN, which is like the first time we've ever done that. Mm. And I am, I'm one sentence ahead of the congressperson because I realize this congressperson is literally reading what I wrote verbatim.
Wow.
And my dad thinks it's recorded. And so normally that would just be like a funny scene, but unfortunately because of his personality, he just starts getting really angry about that. He's, no, what do you mean it's not recorded? Like, why are you always lying, blah, 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 threw a wet blanket over that really cool moment. I thought if he had all of his faculties with him, he might have appreciated that. Oh, my, you love, especially Indian kids, we love when our parents are like really proud of us. And for him to be like, oh, wow, my son's literally rattling off the words before this congressman because the congressman's reading his writing. That would have been a cool moment. But that was one of the last cool moments as a lawyer, because eventually after that, I had to reprioritize and figure out, hey, what am I going to do next? When something like really life-changing happens to you, I think, at least I can speak for myself, to be like extremely vicious with what are the things that you're going to keep in your life and what's going to go out. But yeah, I had moved back home, was in the suburbs. Plot lines were in fact becoming very boring in my actual life and started figuring out, hey, what do I really want from my career? I don't know if I even have the bandwidth with the amount of care that needed to happen at home. I don't know if I have the bandwidth to work at some law firm where everyone brags about how they build 1 hour more than the other person and just how much time you're spending in the office is venerated and held to like such a important part of your story as to whether you get promoted upwards. And it's just how many hours did you bill? As you can imagine, for someone who's Sean Fixton emergency calls and stuff, I don't know if law firm life was ever going to work out, even if this crazy thing hadn't happened at home. But this really made me realize, okay, it can't be that. And luckily, Bloomberg was hiring lawyers like crazy at the time, but not to lawyer as a verb, but to literally help create a legal research tool from the ground up. A great place to work in. Hours were set, were clear. And yeah, cutting out things like, I remember the first house party or any kind of party I went to after all of this had happened. I remember just feeling like out of my skin. I was like, oh, what do people talk about at these things? I was like, I don't know. I don't know if this is like for me anymore. And so I was like, yeah, I think it's time to set some of those things away. And so I think constraints are not only just things you do to generate creativity that can be fun exercises like, oh, now let me make a joke only using the color green or something like that. But it can also be like, hey, these things are no longer important to you and just being really aware that it's not important to you. And so when I went back to DC that one last time, literally to grab my stuff and bring it back to New Jersey in a U-Haul truck, I just had this creative itch and I knew this group had been around called Subcontinental Drift. And it's an open mic of like South Asian singers and slam poets and comedians and storytellers. And it always felt, oh, I'll go to that. It was every month or something. And I was like, oh, I'll go to that this month. And it never came around because I was too busy like lawyering or something before all of this. And it was like a weird, this sounds like it's made up, but like it was a weird calling. Like I had no business going to this open mic when stuff is in a U-Haul. Like, but I went to it and I told a story about me and my dad going fishing and we didn't catch any fish. And the host, still remember her name's Nirali Patel, the host came up to me, who eventually would quit her job at the FTC to pursue poetry, to be a published poet. I just showed up there, told the story, and I'm chatting with Nirali Patel at the end. And she says something like, hey, we really liked your story and I hope you come back again, but can I give you one piece of feedback? And I was like, yeah, like, of course. And she's like, it could be longer. I had been given 5 minutes and the story was 90 seconds. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. It didn't even occur to me. It felt like an infinity that I was up there. I was sweating. It was like it was anything that you can imagine when someone's going up on stage for the first time. And with all of the feelings of, damn, I'm not going to be back here. And so I didn't tell her the entire story about what happened to my dad or anything, but I basically gave her the flip notes and she was like, oh, whenever you're ready, there's a Subcontinental Drift chapter in New York City as well. And that eventually became my home for what I would, that was when I found my tribe, all these other creative people. And every time I would go there, which was once a month, I would tell a brand new short story and they would eventually start to build a bill. I'd take those stories and put them onto a website. That website eventually would get the name Cheese Dosa as I realized, oh, this cheese thing is a very American thing. Dosa is a very Indian thing. And I love food in general, and this could be like a kind of focal point of, oh, if I need to know who he is, it's in this image of a little, what a little fat kid would eat as an American and what a little fat kid would eat as like an Indian kid. And by the end of 2 years or so of going almost every month, or 2 or 3 years, I'd already, you know, passed like 30 stories. And so when it did come time, not to go far beyond your question, but when it eventually did come time to like creating the book, incidentally, the writing of the book was actually the easiest part. The work was like, which ones am I going to cut out? These are the good ones that I'm going to keep. And yeah, I'm just so glad that I went to that place in DC. And honestly, if I'm being honest with myself, a part of why I keep things to just the plot line must be boring is maybe I'm not even ready to explore some of those plot lines and topics.
Thank you so much for sharing that. There's so much in that story, and it's really inspiring how you've transitioned your life, and now so much of it is centered around the things that you love and are important to you.
Yeah.
And also how you have focused on the mundane story. What's interesting to me is there's so much depth underneath all the mundane details of everyday life. So it's almost like what's not said, and I've heard someone describe poetry this way. When you convey a poem, you're leaving a lot of space. There's a phrase, and then there's space, and then there's a phrase, and then there's space. And so you're inviting the listener to engage in the poem and in the work. And a lot of what you're doing with the mundane stories is similar, right? Because there is so much underlying there that you're probably hinting at, especially having with what you've gone through and seen and experienced in life. And so you're really inviting listeners to create their own meaning and put it into their own lives.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up poetry, because as a point of advice I would give as well is, hey, if you think you're a comedian, like, or if you want to be a serious writer or whatever your goal is with your creative pursuits, like, just get out there and join a bunch of groups that have nothing to do with that at all. So every Tuesday at one point in the pandemic, I started joining and was going religiously poetry open mics. And just hanging out with the poets, and then eventually trying my hand at telling my short stories in a way that would feel a bit more poetic. But I think what you're suggesting and what I think I'm doing, I don't know if it's necessarily like always intentional, but I know that I'm always trying to leave the person feeling, I would rather have them, like, instead of just like laughing at the end, I'd rather have them be making like this kind of sound, like a like that, where it feels like home, it feels like I landed the plane, it feels like, oh, like this person made me think about something in a slightly different way too. There's a lot of things I'm trying to achieve, maybe foolishly, by trying to do all of those things and instead of just be funny. But I think a lot of that has to do with just like sitting under the tree of all of these poets, just week in, week out, at a time where we couldn't have been more vulnerable during the pandemic as well.
It's amazing in doing this podcast and through my own experience, I've realized like how important community is to the artistic process, because it's, and you brought this up at the beginning, one, you need feedback and you need a place, a safe space to grow. And I think sharing your work at the beginning is very vulnerable and you're not often ready to share it with a wider audience.
Yeah.
And then I also think it's, you can sometimes be shy in taking on the identity of a writer, a comedian, a poet, songwriter.
It's like such an exciting time when somebody asks you at a barbecue or a house party, like, oh, so what do you do? Like that moment where you feel like, I'm probably going to say customer success manager, but you're not wrong if you just said writer.
Do you say that? Do you say you're a comedian or writer?
Depends on the barbecue, right? I think this is like wearing a lot of different hats, right? If I'm at some event about how to ensure that you can retain as much of your client's revenue as possible, but I just don't know if people who have not tried this creative thing and gone after it, especially if they never even wanted to or never even thought of this because they're just busy with their 9-to-5 job that will eventually get replaced by AI anyway. I just don't know if it's tossing like a grenade into the soup, right? Where it's like, there's an expectation of what this conversation is going to be. Oh, you worked at this place and then you worked at that person. Oh, how do you know that person? Oh, we went to college together. Oh, which dorm were you in? These are the tracks that you usually go on in these kind of conversations. If I just drop writer in there, it feels like irresponsible to, and then obviously so much of this is gauging. If you're standing up and you're performing in front of a bunch of people and basing off of your reactions, you get somewhat good at this, but I can tell who is going to be able to take that and then we can run with it. Maybe they're going to say, oh, I've always wanted to do that. Or, hey, how did you get started? Or you're literally running I clearly must have not been afraid to let you know about any of these creative pursuits when we first met. And it was I think it was literally at one of these kind of conferences.
Which is why our interaction was so different and fun and memorable.
At every subconscious level, I knew, and I think you knew as well, that this is, that we don't have to just
play the narratives.
Yeah, we don't have to talk about the latest enhancement that is on the platform, on the thing that you were, that your company was paying my company on an annual basis to have or whatever. Yeah, but let's say you were someone who just wanted to talk about that kind of stuff. It maybe makes more sense for me to wear that hat. And as an Indian kid living in America, like that amount of that, to code switch between writer and like customer success manager is like jumping over a tiny puddle. It's not particularly complicated for someone who has to be like a good Indian kid who can hang playing Antakshari, which is like a Bollywood based singing game, but then also had to lawyer and then also had to like flirt with people that were not Indian during his dating days. And so that was like,
you were used to the hat switching,
code switching.
I sometimes think about the unbundling of your identity, and it's like certain people you're this, certain people you're one thing, certain people you're another.
I watch my parents, and I've been generational. I watch my parents, they're literally, their accent changes when they're talking to different people. And then I grew up with that influence. So I was like, oh, this is interesting. And I guess I have to do the same thing. There's like this one line when I was 7, 8, or 9 years old from the movie Selena, where the dad is like, we have to be more Mexican than the Mexicans, and we have to be more American than the Americans. But that line is like seared in my head of what it means to be American and Indian. If you're going to succeed on the American side, you're going to do that, but you'll probably lose yourself. So you have to be more Indian than your Indian friends. And I'm constantly overselling how Indian I am. Like some expression, some little phrase or something. I lay it on thick. They're probably rolling their eyes, but I just genuinely would feel very uncomfortable if I was like one of the outside group members because I was not as Indian as they were, or I didn't have the same life experience as they were. That feeling of FOMO and not feeling like part of that group, or like I'm in that group, but I'm not really in that group, would be too much. And definitely lay it on a lot of and most of my knowledge of Indian culture is from the 90s. So they're also like, why is he singing songs from 25 years ago? That's what I got. And yeah.
So you've done stand up and you obviously wrote your book of short stories. How did you think about the different forms of comedy? Improv, stand-up, writing? You've obviously talked about focusing on this mundane aspect, but I'm curious, did you try improv and other forms like that? Do you enjoy do you incorporate when you do stand-up? It seems like you mostly do stories. How much do you think about audience play and interaction like that?
Yeah, so I don't do much audience play and interaction. That is not as much by design as much as I'm not good at that yet. It also, for me, especially with the pandemic and stuff, I knew that a book made a lot more sense for what I was going to do with it afterwards. And I also am someone who needed, back to me thinking I'm an introvert.
Yeah.
I just never got a chance to be introverted. A part of me really enjoys the process of just sitting down, going around with things, not having, you know, you get a lot of feedback as an Indian kid growing up from a lot of different sources. Whether you're at Kumon or your parents or, hey, look at what this other kid did. How come you're not valedictorian? So that drone of a lot of feedback. Obviously, some feedback is good, but there are times where I just want to sit and write. And doing stand-up, you have to be obsessed with feedback if you're going to do it right, which is you have to sit there day in, day out. A lot of the comedians I know that perform on the same stage as me, they are doing this 3 or 4 times a day, 7 days a week. And so they're like performing the same 5 minutes of material, and they're not doing a new story every month like I am. That's the same stuff. Maybe every month or two, a new like 1 minute piece will come in. So that is a completely different space of comedy and the way of doing it than at least that I'm used to. So I'm not suggesting that I can't do it or don't want to do it. I just know that would involve like tearing the whole structure down and doing something completely different in a manner that may not have cross benefits to each other.
Yeah, but I think what's interesting too is like your experience that you brought up at the beginning with your email chain.
Yeah.
That's obviously a form of improv and building off of one another. And yeah. I feel like you do lean into where's the energy and how do you continue to add on to.
Though it is asynchronous, fancy word for everyone, right? Where you get to, while you're writing email thingy, you are thinking, and then when you're delivering it, people are then reading it, and then the comments and responses are coming in a day later, 6 hours later, 1 hour later, stuff like that, where then you then get to respond back to it in a thoughtful manner, et cetera, thing that's going on. But on the topic of improv, during the pandemic, I made friends with a group of various adjunct professors of writing at multiple North Carolina universities. But this group is also where, like, I got to play with other forms. So there was, of course, the poetry open mics I was going to, but I think that was for myself. I don't think they were necessarily, and obviously did not need to be invested in my stories becoming funnier. But this group, like, really sat and parsed through everything I was doing with my storytelling. Like, oh, okay, why did you do that? Have you considered, like, doing XYZ and changing this around? And just really, oh, what's the motivation here? What is the story really about? And, like, almost Socratic methoding me in. But then they also would have a lot of fun. So there was this one thing that they would put together maybe once a month or every 2 months. We would play this one game where there'd be, you know, six or seven of us on the call. And one person would just throw a word into the chat. And whoever wanted to pick up that word would just launch into a story about that word.
Oh, wow.
And it would obviously need to have like a beginning, middle, and end. And it would get you, help you like play with the forms and make you realize that like it doesn't have to be so precious. You don't have to make every word mean so much. Because sometimes if you focus on that first, it's like worrying about the sheen of the paint color on your car before you even have the wheels and the axle. I think sometimes writers can write in a way that, if that works for you, great. If you're like really good at making very detailed sentences and it doesn't, and you still can write stuff that essentially feels like the final draft in your first draft, then great. But I think sometimes just like shooting off and just like throwing a word at someone and then that person turning into a story, you're like, oh damn, maybe this could actually be a story.
Yeah. I think those settings are important because they celebrate the play of it and taking the pressure off. I think what I've noticed in surrounding myself with more songwriters is I'm still a beginner, so I don't have this problem. But they've already put out so many incredible songs. And so now the thing is, how can I live up to the work I've already done? And so every new song is pressure, right? And so it's how do you continue writing more and just go through the reps of it to get better?
Yeah.
Okay. What is it like to have published a book and have your stories out there in the world?
It feels extremely rewarding. Like the idea that it is now emblazoned, it has its own ISBN number and Library of Congress EIN number. Like that feels really cool. This is going to sound like I'm some rapper who made it or whatever, but like they can't take this from you now. Like, it's there. It's official. It never was like the intention was never that I was going to retire off of this book anyway. So the fact the fact that it is complete is what has made this mission feels complete because it was completed. I have this psychological blocker. I still have 30 pages left of Harry Potter, about 25 pages left of The Lord of the Rings. There's something where I feel extremely connected to a piece of art, but I feel like I've lost that connection with the author, et cetera, if I finish those final pages of reading. Same thing goes with my writing, where I'm like, damn, maybe just a little bit more editing. This went on for a few months longer than it needed to. There's something blocking me, and I don't know if this afflicts like other creative people, but I know in general, creative people have a tendency to not be particularly like time-oriented and extremely schedule-oriented. That can be at least often a struggle. You know, I don't have a psychology degree, so I don't know the exact reasons why, but I've seen it in just like in managing people in my job. When I've identified like as someone who happens to be particularly creative, it's just a flag I have in my head.
Right.
But I do know that it's going to be a challenge for them, and how you tap into that and find a way to do that will be different. But yeah, I think that was the biggest challenge here. You're taking something highly creative and then you're filing an ISBN number, you're filing your Library of Congress number, you're trademarking cheese dosa, you are figuring out how the self-publishing thing works, you're identifying whether you sell it through the Amazon KDP, I think it's called, Kindle Direct Publishing, do you use that ecosystem versus another self-publisher called Ingram Spark, where once you do that, everything still belongs to you. So then you can, which is what I ended up doing. So not only did it feel good to finish, awesome. It also felt good to tell. Yeah. And it felt really good to tell Amazon, this is how much your cut is going to be, instead of them telling me what their cut was going to be.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's really cool.
Just that little, those little moments that made me feel a little bit like, oh, this hasn't gone away and is now in the hands of a bunch of other people who are going to take it and move it around and twist it around or anything like that. This is still mine, the entire book in its entirety, the ISBN number, all of it belongs to me. I just leaned in. I was like, I want to have control of all of it, as silly and crazy as that seems. But if you just have an idea, you can get it out quickly.
That's helpful for anyone who's thinking about writing a book. And I think what's so cool is, like you mentioned at the beginning, that you had always had this thought of, I want to write a book someday. So you made it happen and then self-published it.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to circle back on too is that concept of time that you brought up, because that is something I relate to as well. And notice the more you lean into that creative side of your brain, things do get a little bit more unstructured, and including time. But I've also noticed a lot of the artists I admire have channeled that and have been able to create a discipline where it's like, okay, I'm going to show up on days even when I'm in that state of like flow and feeling it, but also on days when I don't, and just train yourself over time. And also, I think what's interesting that you said is by not finishing the writing and the reading, you're keeping that open loop in your brain. So like subconsciously, you're continuing to work on it in the background without you even realizing it. And then that draws like the addiction side back, and you're like, oh, let me keep writing or keep reading. Although I cannot believe you have not finished Harry Potter to this day. That horrifies me.
Yeah, I'm sure it ends in a lovely manner. I'm sure all loose ends are tied. Though, but yeah, a couple of things came to mind when you mentioned that. One is, I'd be remiss if I didn't say this one thing that might be the only valuable thing to the listeners, as opposed to just what my life is about. One like technique that was super helpful for me is this idea of like, how do you create a flywheel of creativity? But it came organically to me, where just having like my iPhone's notepad app out, so that anytime I felt like I have a creative idea, you just put it down in like enough words where you know what that idea is generally. Just get it down there.
Mm-hmm.
If I didn't do that, I wouldn't remember it later. And there was a lot of those ideas firing off. If I write a second book, like I want to write a story from the perspective of the cockroaches on the day that me and my parents left our shoddy little apartment and finally moved to a proper townhouse with a field and everything.
Wow.
I want them to be like drunkenly talking to each other. Here's to the mother who did XYZ, and here's to the son who always would be eating this thing, and just something where, you know, anyways, but there's no way I'm going to remember that story or anything if it's just, it's time to write now. What should I write now?
Oh, yeah,
it's that thing I thought about 2 years ago. So obviously there's not some big technique in putting things into a notepad. But the basic concept is, take your creative ideas are not going to happen on your schedule. And so you put that in the notepad. Mm. And when it's time to write, you now have and you don't know what to write about. You now have a laundry list of all the cool shit that you had thought of yourself. And it's just sitting there. And so then you just can play with that and be like, oh, this is the one I want to write. You still feel like you have freedom. I'm sure that other creative people feel this way, where if you're constrained by a certain time limit or a certain time of the day, you have to get up.
Yeah.
So you already have that list ready to go. Now you can just start teasing out and drawing. And maybe on that day, maybe you just finished the opening scene, but at least that was progress, and you can move on to the next paragraph the next time, or you can just move on to another story later on too.
Yeah.
But you just obsessing over letting the creative stuff come to you and not trying to squeeze or militarize that. Just leaving that alone has really worked for me.
I feel like a key ingredient is staying present to let those ideas come in and then capture them. Okay, so let's see, we're wrapping up soon, but let me ask your thoughts on AI and in writing and comedy.
Ooh.
Hot takes.
Yeah, hot takes. Context is, so I have now a 1-year-old and I have a full-time job. I have a wife. I am trying to write a second book. I am also working with a Netflix personality who is a finalist on a show called Drink Masters. And I loved everything about his cocktail making. And so we're writing a book together. So doing that project while also doing my own personal projects, while also a job, while also a kid. And I'm probably literally forgetting something that I've missed on that list as well. There's not a lot of time for any of this stuff.
Right.
And the entire book proposal I sent over to his agency was 80% of it was written by ChatGPT. And for all the tech nerds out there, this was before ChatGPT was cool. This was like about 2 years ago when I sent that over, the proposal. And just that burden that it's taking off of the nitty gritty. So how many pages is going to be? You have to create a timeline for these agency types who want to know exactly how much budget is going to be, et cetera. So just having the words written, so then I can go in and tweak and edit. I feel like we are just going to there's a real opportunity for one, for us to push out more creative material. I know that may not sound great to a unionized creative writer who literally doesn't have a job because the AI is writing the scripts now. If you watch some Netflix stuff, you're like, yeah, this doesn't feel like a human wrote most of these plot lines or most of this dialogue anymore anyway. So I know that there's another side to this, but for me, it allowed me to push out so much more material, take on an entire extremely cool project with a celebrity bartender that I never thought I would get to do. But yeah, if you want it to feel like you and your voice, it's not going to come from the AI, at least not yet. And yeah, it's been extremely helpful for me. I also think that where we're going, and we have an opportunity to figure out what's important to us, which sounds a little circular, but it has been very important to me to figure out what's important to me. And I don't know if people have necessarily unlocked that, like, AI will give you the opportunity to figure out what's important, because you can now do anything faster. And so what are you going to do now? Are you going to do more stuff? Are you just going to generate more stuff? Are you going to go deep into one subject? Are you going to spend time with your one-year-old now with all the free time that you have? What a wonderful thing, right? Like, we tend to perceive everything in, like, how much less salary or zero salary through the loss of a job, which obviously seems to affect everyone's, like, a national, international consciousness of, oh, but we're going to lose our jobs. That may or may not happen, but you 100% are going to get to spend more time with your kids. You 100% are going to be able to do, instead of one creative thing, maybe two or three. I think those things are not necessarily getting talked about. Coming from someone who wants to write about cockroaches and stuff, hopefully you realize that it's coming from a place of, yeah, I can do that now. You can push out more interesting material. You can just try really cool stuff. If you're a painter, an artist, like, just try it out. It doesn't have to ultimately be your final piece, but for, what do you call it, prototyping of anything, whether it's an idea or an image or a video, music, lyrics, all of these things, like, they're making specific GPTs that are optimized for those.
Yeah, you're talking about the augmentation versus the outsourcing that it can help. I feel like working closely with it, because really, if you're able to put yourself into it, work with ChatGPT, but you'll be able to create so much more.
Yeah. I'd love to know what Gen Z thinks about this, because I feel like Gen Z, let me accidentally say something nice about Gen Z. I feel like they picked up very quickly that they can be the creator of things.
Yeah.
I wonder from their perspective if AI is this, oh my God, it's going to take my job, etc. Or if the creative pursuit is the thing that they want to do anyway, but the job is the thing that just keeps them fed. And this thing, AI, can help the creative pursuit, which is the thing that they actually want. I don't know.
So I love that you talked about switching from an extrovert to an introvert, or really, like, getting in touch with your introvert side of yourself. I relate to that a lot as well. And also, maybe it's the same dimension, maybe it's a different one, but the lawyer side and the creative side. So I'm curious, how do you see those two sides of yourself now? Do they work together? Are they in conflict? How do they support each other? Or
what a lot of lawyers who don't like their jobs tell themselves is, oh, what you're really paying, God knows what you're paying now. But I know back in our day, it was like 40 to 50K a year. So what you're really paying like 150K for is to learn how to think in the first place, or at least how to think like a lawyer. And that's a very expensive amount to pay just to learn how to think. But I do believe that, like, from this idea of, like, lawyers can be so many different things, right? They are, if you're a litigation lawyer, you are very much you are a storyteller. You are literally trying to build a case through the narrative you're creating that slants towards your client's side of how things work. And this can be to disastrous effects, right? And a lawyer is constantly struggling with that as well, where it's, if I can argue both sides, and I've gotten really good at that because I've learned how to think for 150K, then like, where is the truth in any of that anyway? Maybe it's this amorphous thing that never existed to begin with. And you can go down some existential like crisis thinking about that too much, a little bit too. But yeah, for me, I mean, a more practical, straightforward answer to your question is ultimately like, the lawyer side of me will always have my back when it comes to being in front of a room, convincing a bunch of financial types that this is what, there was literally like a multimillionaire that was on a pitch meeting with me and the extremely creative bartender. And I realized, oh, wow, I'm like the monkey in the middle here. Like I can literally speak this guy's language because I know exactly how he's going to think about timelines and how much this costs and market analysis, et cetera. But in any event, I was just like right there in the middle, being able to spread and go a simplified way, like the left brain and right brain, be able to easily play in both of those things. And that's going to be important unless you're truly just making stuff for yourself. If you want it to be out there in the world, like how does this SEO stuff work, that it's going to get viral quicker? How do you actually make the physical book? Like there are certain creative pursuits where there's like a physical thing at the end. That doesn't come from just having the creative itch. Like there's going to be some other element. And maybe that's why you don't have to be a lawyer either, right? You could be an accountant and be just as good at some of the left brain stuff required, maybe even better when it comes to the figuring out the financing and stuff too.
It's been a really interesting journey to see myself and others discover we all have all these parts, but they get turned on at different points in our life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Adi, this has been wonderful. It's been great to hear your story and your thoughts on creativity. So thank you.
Yeah, listeners, we're both smiling from ear to ear.
Hope you enjoyed the episode with Adi Surendran. To learn more about Adi and find him, you can follow his Instagram account, CheeseDoza. You can read his blog, cheesedoza.wordpress.com. And you can find his book, CheeseDoza, on Amazon. I've also heard from a couple people recently who've said that this podcast has been helpful to them in taking the next step in their creative journey, and I love hearing that. If there's anything I can do to be helpful to you in a creative project you're working on or a next step that you're looking to take, please reach out. And if you have ideas how I can make this podcast even better, I'd love to hear from you. Thanks so much.